All right, everyone, I'll give you a heads up on the next few weeks. Next week, we will be having the mayor of Ithaca, Svante Myrick. And if you're interested in learning of some of his backstory, you can find a link on the Thursday Morning Roundtable schedule, or also on the City of Ithaca bio for the mayor. It links to an interview that he did on Rock Center, if you know that television show on NBC, an interview about a lot of his history, his own personal story. It's kind of a short story because he's only 25 years old, but I think, and as somebody said to me the other day, you know, you might want to tell people to come because then you can tell your children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren or whatever in 10 or 20 years when he is maybe in some other venue, hey, I knew him when or I met him when. So I've heard that he's a very good speaker. He certainly has a compelling story, and Ithaca is a neighbor of ours, so I think that will be very interesting. The following week, kind of keeping on the politics of things, we'll be hearing from a panel, actually, on the Political Leadership Institute. And that is a local homegrown effort, not just for people who are interested in running for office, but people who are interested in working with people who are running for office or just the political process. I know we often lament the fact that there aren't more people running for office. We have so many offices that run unopposed on a local, city, town, village, as well as county, state level. This is one of those efforts to try and do something to perhaps change that over time. And then we will end the month. We are expecting a visit from Tom DiNapoli, the state controller. He'd had to reschedule an earlier visit due to one of those coastal storms, but he is scheduled to be here on March 28th. There are a lot of things I think that we will want to hear from him. It's going to be a simple conversation. We're calling it a conversation with the state controller. You know, depending on what's hot at that moment at the end of March, I'm sure he will adjust his comments, but you're always welcome to ask your well-informed questions of him. And then just a heads up into April, the first week in April, we'll have our what has been an annual visit from Mayor Minor from the City of Syracuse. So I think that will be an interesting follow-up to the things that the controller talks about. You might have remembered a couple of weeks ago, the controller issued his fiscal report on the City of Syracuse, as he's doing for other cities in the state. And so I had some things to say about the fiscal outlook, certainly for Syracuse. So please bone up on that. But right now, I'm going to ask one of our newest TMR members to come up and introduce today's guest speaker so that you can also welcome Esteban Gonzalez, who is, I know you won't believe this, those of you who have been around for a while, but actually Dick Carberry has retired again. So I know you don't believe it, but it's true. It's true. So Chief Deputy of Custody at the Onondaga County Justice Center, Esteban Gonzalez, welcome.
Good Thursday morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thrilled to be here. And I have a personal interest in our topic this morning, and you're going to be just as thrilled as I am once you hear this bio that I'm about to read about our speaker. Robert Spitzer, who received a PhD from Cornell in 1980, is Distinguished Service Professor and Chair of the Political Science Department at SUNY Cortland. He is the author of 14 books. Who writes 14 books? Who has the time to do that, including The Right to Bear Arms, The Presidency and the Constitution, Saving the Constitution from Lawyers, my apologies to the lawyers in the room, Gun Control, The Encyclopedia of Gun Control and Gun Rights, and The Politics of Gun Control. He is also series editor for the book series American Constitutionalism for SUNY Press. In 2003, he received the SUNY Chancellor's Award for Excellence in Scholarship. Dr. Spitzer is the author of nearly 500 articles and papers on a variety of American politics subjects. He has testified before Congress on several occasions and is often quoted and interviewed by American and international news outlets. He is also a regular contributor of the Huffington Press and a regular panelist on the weekly public affairs program, The Ivory Tower Half Hour, broadcast on WCNY-TV. Our topic this morning and our speaker is timely, it's relevant, so please help me welcome up Robert Spitzer.
Well, good morning. Now, can you hear me all right? Okay. Very good. I appreciate the invitation to be here today. It's a little strange to be here without my friends and colleagues from the Ivory Tower show. So don't tell them I was here by myself. They won't let me come again by myself if you tell them. So it's okay. I want to actually talk a little today about, well, three things. I want to talk about the history of gun laws, about modern gun law regulations, and about the contemporary political configuration surrounding the gun debate or aspects of it. And then, time permitting, we can have discussion or questions, whatever you'd like to do. Obviously, much attention on gun laws and gun regulations. New York State has enacted recently this new strict gun law called the New York Safe Act, and it was enacted very quickly, and gun owners in New York State, many of them are unhappy with the new law and are hoping to see changes in it. And we think of gun laws as an artifact of modern times, but they're really not. Gun laws, as a matter of fact, are as old as gun possession in America. Now, there's a historical debate about how common gun ownership was in America in its very earliest times, that is, in the colonial period, in the early federal period, and the lead up to the Civil War. Whether many men owned guns or few men owned guns in the early period, guns were always here, right? As soon as the earliest settlers arrived, you know, the Jamestown settlement in 1607, Plymouth Rock, the Plymouth settlement, 1620. I repeat these dates to my students and they look at me like, what's he talking about? Do they not teach that stuff anymore? I don't know, because I'm not, it's just a sidebar curiosity. In any case, so guns were here early, but so were gun regulations. The first indigenous legislature in early America was the House of Burgesses. It was Virginia, the first colony. It established a legislature in 1619. And in the year it was established, it enacted a law that criminalized the sale or giving of guns to Indians, Native Americans, for sort of obvious reasons, punishable by death. That was the penalty for selling or giving a gun to an Indian, as per the Virginia House of Burgesses, 1719. It was the first year that the legislature existed. All kinds of laws were enacted in the 1600s and 1700s, barring the sale or giving of guns to Native Americans, to slaves, not a huge surprise, to vagrants, to people who were not Protestants. Yeah, not every colony had such a law, but many colonies did. You were barred having a gun if you were especially a Catholic. No guns to Catholics. I'm not endorsing it. I'm just saying this was an early law. To those in some colonies, barred or would confiscate guns from anyone who refused to swear a loyalty oath to the government. And this was in the lead up to the Revolutionary period. There were recreational restrictions. For example, North Carolina enacted a law in 1778, this is now during the Revolution, that made it a crime to hunt game by firelight at night. And there are also regulations, for example, that made it illegal in certain counties in Virginia to hunt game with a gun from a skiff, you know, a shallow boat. Oddly, and as some of you know today, you're not supposed to hunt at night, and you're not supposed to hunt by, for example, a car headlight, right? Well, such regulations existed in the 1700s. How interesting. And one of the most common early regulations were laws barring the concealed carry and concealed carrying of weapons. And most states had such laws, and they included firearms, but not only firearms. Typically, these laws would list, and I have the actual text of these laws, and I show these to my students. I teach a course on gun policy as well, and you know, I show the text of these laws to my students so they can see the original text and not someone's description or summary of these laws. But they would typically list not only firearms, especially what we would now identify as handguns, but also certain kinds of knives like bowie knives, something called an Arkansas toothpick. They tended to be knives that people used to attack other people. And the carrying of those particular named types of knives would also be listed typically in state laws as being barred from citizens carrying in a concealed fashion. And they would usually make an exception for people who were just passing through town. And the law would be written in that way. So if you're passing through the area and you're carrying a weapon in a concealed fashion and you keep going, you're not going to run afoul of the law. But those laws were typical. And in addition, this, you know, takes us into the early mid-19th century and the Wild West. And here also there is much misunderstanding of what life in the American West was really like. And as historians of the 19th century American West and American frontier will tell you, there were far, far, far more shootings and killings in American movies and TV shows than there ever were in the actual Old West. Historians have compiled statistics on shootings in frontier Western towns like Dodge City and Tombstone and, you know, the towns that are well known from the movies and celebrated the outlaws who were, you know, engaged in shootouts or allegedly did so. And chiefly what happened was that as soon as settlers moved west and organized or incorporated towns, which was how the West was settled, one of the first things they would do was be set up a government, right? And one of the first actions of any local government would be to bar people from carrying guns in the town. And what would typically occur is that if anybody came to, you know, Dodge City or Tombstone or any place else, and they came with a gun, if it was a local person or somebody coming from somewhere else, you would go to the local sheriff's office or some town office, and you would check your gun, and they would give you usually a metal token. And so you would keep it there until you were ready to leave. So the first thing they do when they incorporate town, for obvious reasons, is to keep people from carrying guns around. So we have the ironic situation, as I've noted in some things I've written, that today there are some states that have laws that are even less strict regarding the carrying of guns than the so-called Wild West of the 19th century. And the actual rates of people being shot and killed, by the way, in these Western towns was far, far, far lower than you would think. It was actually statistically a fairly small number. Most of the actual shooting and violence that occurred in the West in the 19th century was not in gunfights, not between cowboys, not, you know, sort of John Wayne, Gary Cooper images, but involved battles between the American cavalry, the American army, and Native Americans. Final point about guns in early America. During the colonial period and into the federal period, that is after the adoption of the Constitution in 1787, the government would periodically conduct a census of guns. They called them gun censuses, you know, like a census of people. You know that the Constitution requires there to be a census of the population every 10 years where you count all the people. Well, the government regularly conducted gun censuses. I mean, imagine today, there's a knock on the door, right? Hello, I'm from the government. Can you tell me, please, how many guns you have in your home? What kinds are there? How many of them are operational? Well, you can guess what the reaction would be from the gun community, right? But this was a common activity in the 18th and early 19th century. But the government had an abiding interest in knowing how many guns there were and how many of them were operational. So our imagery of our past is often very much at odds with our actual past. And this is something that I write about, and other people have written about this too. So that's just a little bit about the history of gun laws in America. Pardon me for using old-fashioned paper. That's, you know. Yeah, it works fine for me. I have an iPad, and sometimes I use it, but my wife and I shared the expense of buying one, so it works fine. Believe it or not, we share it. It works out just great. My wife is very nice, as evidenced by the fact that she agreed to marry me. So, anyway. So let me say something about modern gun laws. The era of modern gun laws really begins just about a century ago here in New York State. And modern gun laws, modern gun regulations, generally see enactment when one of two things occurs. One is political assassinations, and the other is mass violence. And the sort of significant modern demarcation point was 1911 in New York, when New York City's mayor, a man named William Gaynor, was shot by a disgruntled former city employee in New York City. As a matter of fact, there's a photograph, I show it to my students, of Mayor Gaynor. It's 1911, and he was aboard some kind of vessel in New York Harbor, mayor of New York City, and this man shot him in the throat, I think, and the mayor survived. And standing immediately behind him was Robert Lincoln, the only surviving son of Abraham Lincoln, who was by then an old man. So he was physically present. I mean, it's kind of, you know, one of those historical oddities. In any case, New Yorkers were outraged, and the following year, 1912, the New York State Legislature enacted something called the Sullivan Law, which is still on the books in a modified form, and it was a law that established a system of permitting for handguns. Because handguns were becoming a big problem in American cities in the late 1800s and early 1900s. One of the ironies of the proliferation of guns in America, which really doesn't occur until after the Civil War, is that they are marketed aggressively, you know, sold aggressively, especially Samuel Colt of Colt Manufacturing. Colt was certainly a technological invented a number of technological breakthroughs regarding the development of guns and particularly handguns, but he was also a genius at marketing. And one thinks of guns being manufactured to be sold to Westerners, but by and large, the main market for guns, especially handguns, was Easterners, people living in the East in large cities. And so you begin to see a dramatic upsurge in handgun ownership in large cities and a parallel upsurge in shootings. And this begins to, you know, arouse the concern of civic groups, of good government groups and others. And the first sort of specific outcome of that was the Sullivan Law in New York State. The federal government enacted a couple of fairly minor gun laws in the 1920s. But in 1934, the first modern, significant national gun law is enacted, called the National Firearms Act, and its chief purpose was to regulate so-called gangster-style weapons. And during this period of time, we're in the height of the Depression, and gangster violence is really kind of prevalent. It makes huge news headlines, and in fact, the killing of Bonnie and Clyde, which has been dramatized in, you know, one well-known movie and many other places, occurred just a couple of months before this law was enacted. John Dillinger, the notorious gangster, some of my students have seen the movie about Dillinger with, you know, Johnny Depp that was in the movie theaters a couple of years ago. So at least they know that story, where he was killed in Chicago in 1934, the woman in the red dress, right, who, it was a hot summer night, he went to the Biograph Theater as he's coming out with the woman in the red dress, they capture and shoot him in an alley near the movie theater. So the killing of Dillinger, this was, you know, major headline in headlines in the news around the country. So you have this orgy of gangline violence crescendoing in the early 1930s, and that primarily provides a major impetus to the enactment of this law, the National Firearms Act of 1934. There had also been an assassination attempt against Franklin Roosevelt in 1933. It was after he was elected president, but before he took the oath of office. He was in Florida giving a speech, and a disgruntled man, you know, had a handgun, was in the audience, kind of stood up on a wobbly chair, and the chair's kind of wiggling, and he takes a shot at Roosevelt, misses Roosevelt, but hits the guy who's sitting next to him, who happened to be Mayor Anton Cermak, mayor of Chicago. Cermak is killed. Roosevelt survives unharmed and sort of showed great kind of bravery at the scene at that particular moment. So that also was kind of on the minds of Americans, too, as the following year Congress enacts the National Firearms Act. The chief thing that law did was, as I said, curtail civilian access to gangland-style weapons, fully automatic weapons like machine guns, sawed-off shotguns, and other kinds of exotic weapons. And indeed, that law was extremely successful in doing just what it set out to do, to severely restrict civilian access and criminal access to fully automatic weapons. And as anybody will tell you today, it's possible, you know, there are civilians who own some of these weapons, but they're heavily licensed, regulated. You're fingerprinted and photographed by the federal government. Generally speaking, it's collectors who have, you know, old Tommy guns from the 20s or 30s, that sort of thing. But it was a law that was extremely effective in regulating a category of gun that the government thought civilians ought not to have. And it succeeded in keeping them out of the hands of civilians and out of the hands of criminals. There were some other more minor regulations thereafter. The next major sort of gun law, gun regulation, was the Gun Control Act of 1968. This also was a response to two sets of things, a rising tide of urban violence in the late 1960s, and specifically the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy in the spring of 1968, and that provides kind of the final impetus for enactment of this law, which imposed new regulations. Then jumped to 1993 and 1994. Congress enacts the Brady Law in 1993, the law that established background checks for purchases of a handgun nationwide. And the following year, 1994, Congress passes the assault weapons ban, which was in place for 10 years. It lapsed. It was in place from 1994 to 2004 and barred 19 named types of assault weapons plus a couple of dozen copycat models. And the law lapsed in 2004 because it was written into the legislation that way. It was one of the compromises that was included in the law to win its passage. Both very controversial, of course, but both coming as the result of shootings that had occurred in the previous few years that had aroused public ire. There was a final gun control effort that occurred at the national level after Columbine, the Columbine High School shooting in April of 1999, and that occurred in Congress in May and June of that year, and U.S. Senate enacted some stronger gun measures that eventually dies in the House of Representatives, so it doesn't quite win enactment, but Congress came close to enacting some new measures that, among other things, would have closed the so-called gun show loophole. So my point is that there's a certain political arc or political cycle that you can very specifically identify with the moments when such laws have been passed in previous times, and the current situation very much conforms to that political cycle and political dynamic. And that takes us sort of to the current period, that is, how did we get here in 2013, where Congress is now seriously debating some new gun control measures, including reinstitution of an expanded assault weapon ban, enactment of a provision to restrict access to bullet magazines holding more than 10 bullets. This is in the proposed federal law, to standardizing and having universal background checks for handgun purchases and improved record keeping. Some of those measures have won bipartisan support, others have not. But there's a political backstory to that, and it begins with the 2000 presidential election. So the Bush-Gore election. So Al Gore runs for the presidency as the Democratic nominee, and he makes stronger gun laws a significant plank in his platform to run for the presidency. Bush, his opponent, opposes stronger gun laws, although he does support, he says, renewal of the assault weapons ban. And Gore loses the election, and many Democrats felt that the gun issue was why Gore lost. And they pointed in particular to the fact that he lost the electoral votes of three states, of his home state of Tennessee, Arkansas, which was Bill Clinton's home state, and the state of West Virginia. And had Gore won any of those states, he would have won the election in the Electoral College. And so Democrats feel this gun issue, gee, it really hurt him. There was also a feeling, and Bill Clinton said, that the Democrats lost control of the Congress in the 1994 midterm elections because they passed the assault weapons ban. And so Democrats feel, look, this issue is hurting us. It's not worth the trouble. We want to expand our tent anyway to try and recapture majority control of Congress, to win back the presidency at a later time. And so at the national level, Democrats begin to move away from the gun issue, and they're just not interested in dealing with it. They also are trying to bring into the Democratic Party blue dog Democrats, more conservative Democrats, including Democrats who support gun rights. Now, there's been last year there was an important series of articles that reported research on these elections, which essentially demonstrated that the gun issue, that Bill Clinton was incorrect in 1994. The gun issue was not responsible for the Democrats losing control of Congress. And people who study Congress, specialists kind of know this to be the case anyway. Basically, it occurred because there had been shifts, there had been population shifts, such that you had a whole coterie of Democrats who had been elected from districts that really were Republican districts, and the Republican by the composition of those districts, and the Republicans were able to capitalize that in 1994. They're well-funded, they're coordinated, and they win back control of Congress. It wasn't the gun issue any more than it was really the gun issue that caused Gore to lose that election. Gore would have lost those three states anyway in the year 2000. But anyway, the Democrats think the gun issue has really hurt them. So they pretty much avoid the issue. And the gun issue is one that traditionally has been split, at least at the national level, between the two parties. Well, the Democratic Party has generally supported stronger gun laws, and the Republican Party has tended to emphasize gun rights instead. So those two things occur. Gore loses, the Democrats move away from the gun issue, and of course George W. Bush is elected president. And the second Bush administration was undoubtedly the most gun-friendly presidential administration in all of American history, period. I mean that in a public policy sense. I don't mean that, you know, that Bush was, you know, constantly shooting at targets or something. I mean, I'm not talking about his personal habits. I'm talking about his public policy, the policy of his administration. And indeed, we see during the Bush presidency the NRA, the so-called gun lobby, really getting its wish list realized during this period of time. Pretty much everything it wants, it gets, thanks in large measure to the aggressive support of the Bush presidency and John Ashcroft, who is Bush's first attorney general. Significant restrictions on access to gun data are imposed, even access to that data by law enforcement. We find that there are some early studies in 2001, before these limits are clamped on, that examine, that cross-check the terrorist watch list after September 11 attacks with gun trace data that shows some intersection, that there are people on the terrorist watch list who are also getting guns legally. But that analysis comes to an end because the Bush administration says, no, you can't look at that data anymore. So even that degree of data access is restricted. In 2005-2006, Congress enacts a very important law that extends liability protection or immunity to the gun industry and to gun manufacturers, making it extremely difficult to bring lawsuits against them. Not impossible, but very difficult. giving the gun industry a degree of liability protection that no other industry has. And then in 2008, the Supreme Court hands down a very important and also controversial decision called District of Columbia versus Heller, in which the Supreme Court says for the first time in history that the Second Amendment, you know, the right to bear arms, protects a personal or individual right to have a handgun for personal protection in the home. Now, many Americans, in fact, most Americans, always kind of figured that that's what the Second Amendment meant anyway, but as a matter of law and history, it never meant that. Not until 2008. Historically, by previous court rulings, by debate in the first Congress in 1789 when the Second Amendment was formulated, debated, amended, and discussed, the Second Amendment, let me just say, the Second Amendment says this. It says, a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Well, what about all that well-regulated militia stuff? Chief Justice Warren Burger, who was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in the 1970s and 80s, said once that the Second Amendment is best understood by beginning it with the word because. That is, because a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep bear arms shall not be infringed. That is to say, the Second Amendment was always understood to protect the right of citizens to own guns, but only in connection with service in a government-organized and regulated militia, which also goes to a historical fact that most people probably don't know, which was that early in the country's history, our military needs were met primarily by militias, but more to the point, state and federal governments didn't possess the resources to arm militiamen. So militia-eligible males, those essentially between the ages of 18 and 45, were required by law, to own guns for militia service. Now, it also turns out that those laws were never really enforced. There was a fierce debate in Congress. Such a law was passed in Congress in the Militia Act of 1792. And there was a penalty provision in that federal law, but that penalty provision was stripped out, much to the dismay of President George Washington. And as a consequence, guess what? Nobody really paid it much attention. Nevertheless, the whole notion of the Second Amendment is predicated in part on the idea that citizens had to get their own weapons because that was part of their obligation of service to their state and country. Ergo, the wording in the Second Amendment. But that's been lost to history to a great degree. So in 2008, the Supreme Court does an about-face, even though they pretended it really wasn't, sort of this shell game in Antonin Scalia's majority opinion. You know, you may agree or disagree with the conclusion of the court as a matter of policy or a matter of law, but most historians will tell you that Scalia's decision, and generally the decision in the Heller case, is based on primarily on history. It's really not about law. It's really all about history. And one of the most history-driven Supreme Court cases you can find, and most historians will tell you that his history is counterfactual, to say the least. I mean, it is. It just is. I mean, for example, Scalia says in the decision that there is no historical evidence to support the idea that the phrase keep and bear arms had a military connotation. Scalia says flatly, there's no evidence to support that. Well, not only is there evidence to support it, virtually all of the evidence that exists supports the idea that the phrase keep and bear arms is a military term. You don't keep and bear arms against a rabbit or a deer. Okay? And that was well understood in the 18th century. But Scalia just says, because he's a Supreme Court justice and he can say what he believes the law to be, that no, there's no historical. I mean, it's stupefyingly false. Okay? I mean, there's no debate about it. It's simply false. Okay? Scalia is wrong. All right? You can say what you want about the law, but as Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan once said, and I know what you know what I'm going to say, right? That people are entitled to their own opinions, but not their own facts, except Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court. Okay. Anyway, so you have the Heller case coming along in 2008, which, you know, for the first time enshrines this personal right of you know, average citizens to have guns. But the court also goes to great pains to say basically that existing gun laws are fine, you know, by and large. And so because the Democratic Party is silent, because we have an administration that is very much on the pro-gun rights side, you find public opinion shifting on this issue, and there's less support in the public for stronger gun laws, generally speaking, and nobody's advancing them at the national level anyway during the decade of the 2000s. But then, of course, we have, there was, you know, sort of a crest tide of well, we have a new president, Barack Obama, who's much more sympathetic to stronger gun laws. And then you have these, you know, terrible mass shootings, the Aurora, Colorado movie shooting last July, and then the, you know, the awful Sandy Hook shooting on December 14th of last year. And the public mood changes, and Barack Obama has just been reelected, right? Sort of that honeymoon period after or an election or a reelection. The president has a mandate. Presidents always use a new term to, you know, say to the country, here are some major big-ticket items I want to promote, because it is an opportunity for any new president or any president who's been reelected, and that coincides with this public moment on the gun issue, and so Obama decides to forge ahead with newer gun laws. Will any of it be enacted? I think there's a better than 50-50 chance that some elements of proposed national laws will be enacted. It seems from what the pundits say that the assault weapons ban that's being debated by Congress probably will not be enacted. It just isn't, you know, aren't the votes there. But that there are some bipartisan coalitions to support some other elements of that package. So that's kind of my take on various aspects of the gun issue. So I'd be happy to yield time and see if you have any questions or comments or the like.
Do we have a question? We have a question in the back. Do you have, while I'm walking to the back of the room, I'm going to ask you about the New York State's particular gun law, and if you have any thoughts on if that is going to survive.
It seems likely that it will. They are talking about tinkering with the law, at least in some small respects, notably to exempt police officers and retired police officers so they can carry handguns that, or have handguns that hold more than, bullet magazines that hold more than seven. The mental health community is very concerned about kind of the open-ended wording regarding reporting of you know, mental health patients who seem to pose a risk or a danger, that sort of thing. But the law itself, it seems pretty clear, is probably going to stay in place by and large pretty much as it is. That seems to be the case.
Sandra just took my question, but I have another one anyway. It's always a backup question. No, the issue I'm interested in your thoughts. As people and a lot of gun owners are very rabid about their right to own them, it seems. I'm not one, as you probably could figure out by now. But my question goes to, the discussion seems to always revolve around, is it for protection or is it for hunting? Are the two main things that always seem to come out? And that's where they're saying that's why they have a right to do it. Is that really the major impetus for the people that want to have that right to bear arms? Or is there some other thing and they just use that as a something that's acceptable?
Well, those are indeed the two most important reasons why people say they own guns. Most people own long guns. There are twice as many long guns as there are handguns in America. All right. And most people who own long guns, although obviously there are many people who own both. And people own long guns, give as their primary reason, hunting and sporting purposes, you know, go hunting, deer hunting in the fall or target shooting and the like. The main reason people give for owning handguns is personal self-protection. Now, in terms of rights, there's no such thing as a constitutional right to hunt, let's say. On the other hand, people often misunderstand to say that if it's not in the Constitution, somehow it's not a right, and that's not exactly correct. Hunting is perfectly legal. It's subject to regulation. If there's a deer running down the middle of Blandina Street, you're not allowed to take a shot at it, or, you know, Salina Street in the city of Syracuse. Can't discharge a firearm in city limits, right? certain, you can only hunt at certain times of the year, things like that. So hunting is subject to regulations, but it's a perfectly legal activity. There are lots of things people do that are perfectly legal, legitimate. They're not protected by the U.S. Constitution or, for that matter, by the New York State Constitution. And it turns out that the New York State Constitution is one of six states that does not have a right to bear arms type provision within the state constitution. Most states do. Many states added that in the last 30, 40 years or so. But protection is very much related to people's ownership of handguns, and that's part of the somewhat circuitous argument about assault weapons, and this is also a very controversial and somewhat confusing subject for understandable reasons, because sometimes people say they want to own assault weapons for personal protection, and there's a couple of problems with that. The first is, if you, under the Second Amendment, as the court has interpreted it, if you want to own a gun for protection, you're entitled to do that, but it doesn't have to be an assault weapon. I mean, you can have a gun without it being an assault weapon. So you don't need a category of an assault weapon for personal self-protection per se. Secondly, if you choose an assault weapon for personal self-protection, you've probably made a terrible choice. It's for sort of practical reasons. You're probably better off, as Vice President Biden said, with a shotgun or arguably with a handgun. So this gets to the question of why the dispute about assault weapons. But you're absolutely right. Protection and hunting are the two chief reasons that people focus on in terms of gun ownership.
Dr. Spitzer, by the way, thank you for coming today. I enjoyed your speech today, and I enjoyed it at Hendricks Chapel. I have a comment, and then I have a question. There's a new truce initiative in Syracuse, New York, in relation to handgun violence in the Gangland District. And it was part of an initiative by David Kennedy from John Jay University, who brought it to Boston, Cincinnati, and other cities, and it helped in relation to gangland violence. I would like you to comment on the new SAFE law and whether or not that attacks the gangland violence issue. That's one question. And two, whether or not the straw purchase legislation in Congress will pass.
Sorry, the
straw man purchase legislation. And I may have misspoke a little bit,
yeah.
But the two issues, whether or not the SAFE law in New York has any effect on the inner city violence, and two, whether the straw man purchase issue will pass through Congress.
Yeah, good question. With respect to the first, I don't know regarding the state law. Except that one provision of the SAFE law is that it does impose new restrictions on bullet magazines, limiting them to those that hold seven or fewer. And there is a public safety law enforcement concern about large capacity bullet magazines for a very simple reason, which is that when people have guns that include large capacity magazines, they're more likely to shoot more bullets. For example, in the 1980s, the New York City police went from the old, I don't know if it was a six-shot revolver, but it was basically, you know, the kind of traditional handgun that you would associate with law enforcement from prior eras. And the law enforcement union wanted to go to Glock-style weapon for police officers, and the police chief of New York City was very much against it, oddly enough. And the reason why was because he was concerned that police officers would simply shoot more on scene, and wherever every bullet you fire, especially in a city, you know, where are those bullets going? And he finally yielded, and officers in New York City, and it's pretty common now, that the Glock-style weapon has clips or magazines that hold larger numbers of bullets. In fact, they can hold up to 30, which is quite remarkable given the technology of a handgun. Although that's not, those aren't the ones that officers carry, I think. They have 11 or 15 rounds in them, typically, some number like that. Anyway, what happened was when New York City police officers issued the Glocks, they discovered that indeed police officers shot more times when they were using their guns in the line of duty than before. And that was kind of gave rise to the concern that the police chief had. But, of course, there's training and other things you do with police officers to make sure that if they're firing, that they're doing it appropriately. So the chief problem, there's a criminological problem with having larger capacity bullet magazines available to the civilian population for the reason that people are more in possession of them are more likely to shoot more bullets. So in that one respect, I would tie that to the criminological issue that you raised. Now, I would also add that the chief part of the confluence of the debate around assault weapons is that the vast majority of gun crimes are committed with handguns. 80%, pretty consistently, 80% of gun crimes are committed with handguns, even though handguns are harder to get and there's fewer of them in America. So the sort of a larger argument to make, which is, look, if you're really interested in getting at the connection between guns and crime, the main focus should be handguns. You know, why this obsession with assault weapons? And there actually is sort of reasons why for that. But and that's a fair enough question. In terms of the New York SAFE Act, I couldn't say with certainty about other provisions. I mean, that's a perfectly fair question, but I don't have a good answer for you here today aside from the bullet magazines.
There are certainly those out there that have their deep-seated beliefs that this issue should not be, that the facts of this issue are something they're willing to engage and argue on from both sides, but certainly those that are resisting any additional regulation. What about those that refuse to engage in the argument and simply retract to this is the beginning of the erosion of our liberties and forget about the facts, forget about engaging in the argument, I refuse on all accounts. What is the counter to that discussion or argument?
Well, it's the slippery slope. I mean, part of the problem with that argument is that it really is not an argument about the policy proposal at hand. It's about a hypothetical future. You know, if we register guns today, well, the jackbooted fascist government agents will be pounding on our doors at midnight to take all our guns away sometime thereafter. And part of the unfortunate consequence of the gun debate, especially in terms of gun rights organizations, is that they pound away on these scenarios. And part of that rhetoric is a deeply angry anti-government rhetoric. It's more than just a policy debate about, well, where should the line of government regulation be? It's about you cannot trust your government. It's on the verge of, you know, fascism or tyranny or some such thing. And that opens the door to a whole array of arguments that I think are really troubling, because the essence of government in every realm is about, you know, where do you draw this line between order in society and freedom. And obviously we need order in society and we value freedom. I mean, if you don't think we need order, I'll get in my car and drive back to Cortland on Route 81 in the wrong lane, okay? Yeah, you need, right? You need order because there are 312 million Americans and there are certain things that people really should be, you know, doing and not doing. And that logic applies to guns no less than anything else. Ironically, we're in a situation today where guns as a consumer product are regulated less than most other consumer products you can think of, not more. Okay, the liability protection law I mentioned earlier is a good example of special protections that are given to the gun industry. And it's constitutionally, there is no impediment, Second Amendment impediment, to regulating the industry and regulating use, et cetera, of guns. There are clear limits or clear standards which say people are entitled to have guns for protection. But as the point, part of the point I'm making is that gun regulations are as old as guns in America. So you cannot make the argument that somehow the people who wrote the Second Amendment or the Constitution's founders abhorred such regulations, because it was not the case. I think they would have been puzzled by the modern debate. The slippery slope allows you to avoid arguing the facts of the case before you, and that's why I think it's a problem.
Tim Dickinson, in a recent Rolling Stone article, argues that the major change in the landscape on gun control legislation discussion is that the gun industry has taken control of the NRA, and there may in fact be a very great difference between the membership of the NRA and the current gun industry leadership. What are your thoughts about that?
I'm not sure I would say the gun industry has taken over sort of the political movement so much as kind of the reverse. It's clear that the gun industry has, I mean, the gun industry has benefited enormously from all of the controversy about assault weapons, because the gun industry, in business terms, in modern decades, is not especially profitable. But assault weapons are tremendously profitable to gun manufacturers. And so anything that gins up those sales is beneficial to them. And I would say that the gun industry and the gun lobby, or the National Rifle Association and its allies, have one abiding interest in common, which is to have as many guns in as many hands as possible. Period. Why? Obviously, if your business is selling guns, you want to sell guns. And guns are a very durable commodity, right? Their shelf life is very, very long. You take a gun and buy it and put it in your dresser drawer, you'll be able to pull it out in 40 years. And fire. I mean, and even if you use it regularly, as long as you sort of do minimal maintenance, it's going to be around for a long, long time. So it's a durable commodity. And in a business model, you'd rather have a disposable commodity, right, than a more durable one, because people buy more of your product. So anything that sells more products, in a business sense, obviously, is in your interest. Politically speaking, the base of the NRA and the gun community is gun owners. Now, most Americans don't own guns. About 80 million Americans are gun owners today. Maybe it's a little higher than that, but it's about that number. And it's actually been declining as a percentage of the population. Gun ownership has been declining since about the early 1960s. In the early 1960s, half of all households had at least one gun. Today, it's about a third of all households have at least one gun. And there are more guns in America by quantity today. But chiefly, that's because the average gun owner owns more guns. So the average gun owner in the early 1960s owned, you know, 2.5 guns on average, right? It's like you have 1.6 kids and 1.4 dogs or something, right? You know, it's a statistical average. Today, the average gun owner owns 5 or 6 guns. there are certainly some people who go out and get a gun who have never owned a gun before, but by and large, it's a habit that is the province of middle-aged white males. And if you look at gun ownership correlated by age, you find that the younger you are, the less likely you are to own a gun. And the likelihood is that by the time you turn 18, by the time you're an adult, if you're not a gun owner, you probably won't become one. It's not a habit you tend to acquire once you're an adult. Chiefly, people own guns because it's a practice that's handed down through families. You know, your parents own guns, or, you know, you went hunting with your father, that sort of thing. And there's just less and less of that occurring. And, you know, the gun community understands that demographic. So anything that presses guns into the hands of more people, because gun owners are the political base for the NRA and the commercial base for the gun industry, they have that abiding, you know, commonality. So where the tail wags dog, dog wags tail, the political result is pretty much the same.
Most of the policy that we have in the United States has been determined by Congress based on data. And yet, the Congress has decided that we cannot gather information on guns. What was the rationale for them to do so?
Well, the short answer is because the NRA was extremely successful in pressing members of Congress to attach measures to bills pretty quietly, pretty much unnoticed, to suppress and thwart data collection, data analysis, data reporting. And there are a series of measures that Congress enacted. And, you know, The NRA does its best politically. It's a very effective interest group, without question, but does its best in times of normal politics when people are paying attention mostly to other things. And it was during such periods of, you know, call it normal politics, when legislatively restrictions were put on funding of gun research, on access by researchers and by law enforcement to gun data, and other things. And they argue that they, you know, did these things, pressed these changes, because it was resulting in biased research, which the translation is it was resulting in research. And there is no question that more research is needed. We have some information because there are some studies you can do. And actually some news organizations have on their own done some fairly extensive research. For example, you can go to public newspaper sites if you want to chart information about mass shootings, for example. How many have there been? What kinds of weapons were used? How many people were killed? You know, what are those details? I mean, that's important information. But the government hasn't done those studies because of these impediments. But some news organizations have. And so we're starting to get, you know, more information, more data. Clearly, there needs to be more. And one of the things that Obama has done is proposed that, you know, these restrictions on research be lifted.
Are you alone in your study of gun policy? I'm just thinking you mentioned news organizations, you mentioned government, but how about academia? Are there not studies going on?
There are, mostly in, one of the things that's interesting about this subject for me is that it really spans many fields. It's law, it's history, it's public health, it's the medical community, even people in philosophy, and of course criminology. There are, most of the people who study the kind of the criminological consequences of guns are, you know, trained criminologists, which isn't exactly my field, although I read a lot of this literature and try and understand it. Mm-hmm. In political science, I'm one of the relatively few people that looks a lot at this particular issue, which, you know, is fine. But there are people in many disciplines, many fields who study the issue.
One of the things I have found very interesting is that following a terrorist act or a mass shooting, government calls for tighter gun control. And yet, following 9/11, we armed pilots in cockpits of our planes. Now we're calling to arm teachers and administrators in schools. I'd like your thoughts.
It's true. And often there's not a correlation between the arming process and the actual or perceived threat. So, for example, after 9/11, you're right that pilots were armed. Initially, the pilots' union was against the idea, but they came on board with it. But pilots have to undergo certain training and things like that. But there was also an upsurge in gun sales among civilians after 9/11. Were terrorists going to come to Syracuse, New York? You know, probably not, right? If you owned a gun, would it have helped you out if you were working in the World Trade Center on September 11th? You know, really no. But it was kind of people's diffuse response to insecurity and fear of crime, of terrorism, and so you do find these kinds of cycles where citizens sometimes respond in this way. There has been discussion about arming of teachers in public schools. I've talked some about this on my campus and elsewhere because of these, you know, obviously terrible mass shootings. But teachers are almost uniformly against the idea, and more to the point, even when you factor in mass shootings at public schools or colleges and universities, they represent statistically, and I don't mean to minimize these shootings, but statistically they represent an almost unmeasurable number of deaths and injuries in relation to total, you know, gun deaths and injuries in America every year. And again, I'm not minimizing them in any respect, but more to the point, public schools and colleges and universities are actually very safe. As a matter of fact, school children are statistically safer in school than they are on the streets or even in their own homes in terms of, you know, risks of injury, death, and other things. So our schools are objectively really very safe, and we need to remind ourselves that that's the case, just as is true on college campuses. Even though campuses are very open places, virtually all campuses don't allow people to carry guns except for university police officials. So, you know, it's important to have that, you know, statistical moment, to call it that, to remind yourself that our children are pretty safe. We want to do as much as we can to protect them, and that includes, you know, understanding better the behavior of mass shooters, and there's a lot of stuff that we're learning about that that suggests things that more things that could be done. But our public schools are really pretty safe, and so are our colleges and universities.
Amen. Thank you, Bob Spitzer.
Thank you all.